today. I don't know why I'm telling you all this stuff about the Bodhisattva's activity. Why on earth? I don't even know why I'm thinking about it. It's completely beyond us. Oh well, that's what we've got to do. Of course, it's completely beyond us as individuals, because if you think of yourself as an individual being a bodhisattva, well, you're denying what it is to be a bodhisattva. Do you see what I mean? Because a bodhisattva is giving up self-attachment. So to be a bodhisattva, you have to let go of that. I think what that means for us is that it's sort of safer, if that's the right word, more effective, not to think in terms of trying to be a bodhisattva, but trying to participate in the bodhisattva's activity. And trying to participate in it with others who are trying to participate in it. In effect, that's what a centre is about. That's what a sangha is about, that gathers around a centre. That's what the total sangha of Tri Ratna is about. That's what the total Buddhist Mahasangha is about, or the total sangha of all beings of goodwill. We're trying, all of us, to participate in a spirit, to put it that way, that is completely beyond us as individuals. I have more to say about that, but it just struck me this morning as I was on my way here. What am I talking about all this stuff for? So I hope you get my meaning. Don't think I've got to do all this, but I have to participate. I can participate with others to let this activity flow through the world. So we're going through the 11 modes. We've done a couple already, and we've got, by a quick reckoning, 9 to go. So first of all, there's the general injunction to render assistance. First of all, assessing the needs and deciding what is to be done, so that you use your efforts, or the efforts of the bodhisattva, the collective efforts of all those who give themselves to the bodhisattva spirit, you use them where they're most needed. Archimedes is famous for having said, "Give me a fulcrum and I can move the world." So if you can find the right place to put your efforts, you can make a big difference. If you scatter your efforts over too much, it's wasted. Secondly, the bodhisattva teaches beings, sentient beings, with relevancy. So this is effective communication, just in a few words. We talked a bit about this yesterday. Making sure that you're communicating in the way that really gets across, and that comes from a recognition of what the other person's needs are, what their interests are. Here it talks about if people are stingy, if they're miserly, if they're interested in having lots and lots of goods, we'll teach them that if you perform skillful karma, what you need will come to you. Putting it very simply. But I hasten on. I've got 5 to do this morning, the first part, and 4 this afternoon. I'm determined to finish it all, even if it's a bit of a scamper. So, I'm not going to read each of them because that takes up a bit too much time. But the third of the 11 modes begins with the words, "Furthermore, the bodhisattva, seeing an occasion for showing gratitude to sentient beings who have helped him or her, treats them with respect." And it goes on in that sort of vein. It's quite interesting that this is named as a mode of the bodhisattva, that the bodhisattva shows gratitude, and not just shows gratitude in the sense of expressing it, but acts upon it. And it's quite a deep meaning to this. It's interesting if you know the story about the Buddha at Bodh Gaya. Many of you will have heard the story of the 7 weeks that the Buddha spent at Bodh Gaya. First week under the Bodhi tree, and then 6 weeks under other trees around the place. And of course, this is semi-legendary. We don't know what the truth behind it all is. But after he'd sat under the Bodhi tree, he moved a little to the north. Many of you know Bodh Gaya. He moved onwards round the ambulatory. And a little bit outside that ambulatory, on the northern side, there's the remains of a stupa, which probably marks a spot where he stood for 1 week, according to the story, gazing unblinkingly at the Bodhi tree, gazing at it with deep gratitude, because it had sheltered him at the time of his final effort of breakthrough. What I take this to mean is the tree comes to represent everything that had supported the Buddha, everything that had sheltered the Buddha in his struggle for enlightenment. And his first instinct, having broken free of all conditions, was gratitude. Pali, it's katanyata. In Sanskrit, krutagnyata. Krutta is that word related to karma, meaning done. Do you remember kaukrutya? The same sort of root word. And agnya is one of those words that relates to the Indo-European nya, or kna in English, in German, ken, know, cognition, and so forth. So it means knowing what has been done. Kritanyata means your awareness of the benefit that has been given to you. This is considered extremely important in the Buddha Dhamma. If you're not aware of what has been done for you, of the benefit that you've accrued from the actions of others, from all the help that you've received, always starting with your parents, regardless of how they treated you later, always starting with your parents and onwards through your life. If you're not aware of what you've benefited from living beings, you don't value what you've got, if you see what I mean. If people have given you something and you don't value it, if you're not aware of what they've given you, then, well, you won't appreciate it. I'm not putting this extremely well, but you get what I mean, that in order to know what you've been given, in order to appreciate what you've been given, you need to know that you've been given it. So gratitude is considered the basis for good qualities, because you appreciate the actions that others have performed for you, you feel gratitude. Gratitude is the recognition of what they have done for you, therefore your valuation of it. Of course, this especially applies to your teachers, to your brothers and sisters in the Sangha, to all those who've helped you on the way, imperfect as they may be. Your teacher may be riddled with faults, but he or she has introduced you to the Dhamma, enabled you to practice the Dhamma. And if you're aware of that, you will feel it. And if you feel it, well, you'll value what you've got. So the Bodhisattva experiences deep gratitude for what he or she has received from other living beings. And out of that gratitude returns the favor, as it were, acts in a helpful way, not in exchange in the sense of you did this for me, therefore I'll do that for you, but out of a feeling of connection, a feeling of gratitude, you respond to others when you see they're in need. So if you don't do that to those who've helped you, then you're not going to do it for anybody else. And it's as if all beneficial activity towards others is founded upon your gratitude to those who've helped you. Then the whole sort of theme of helpfulness is alive for you, because you're aware of it in relation to yourself. You know, if you think, I did it my way, I never depended on anybody else, then you tend to think, well, let them sort themselves out. If you're aware of how much you've received and how much you are linked into the beneficial community, both in the most immediate sense of your own spiritual surroundings, your family, and your whole culture with all its defects, if you're aware of all that, then, well, you'll give back. It's natural to give back. But in some forms of Buddhism, it's said that you recognize that all living beings have at some time benefited you. In the countless eons of history, everybody has been your kind mother. That's what you're asked to think. It's a bit of a stretch, isn't it? But you get the point. It's sort of saying that life has benefited you. If you really appreciate what you've gained from life, from living beings, you will give back. So you start, the Bodhisattva starts with an intense awareness of what he or she has received from other living beings. That's why so much emphasis is placed in Buddhist tradition on gratitude to your parents, because they formed your body, they created this life that you've come into. You know, we know that nobody ever has a good enough parent, and that no parent can ever be good enough. I hope we're all aware of that now. But they gave you life. Often they've nurtured you. They've done their best for you, even if they abandoned you. And sometimes parents can act very cruelly. Even if they did that, they've still given you life. And so the Bodhisattva is aware of the benefit that he's received or she has received from other living beings, from that most basic of gifts of life, right the way to the gift of the Dhamma and guidance in the Dhamma. The binding force of compassion in some way is gratitude. It's not abstract. It's related to what you've received. So if the more you develop a sense of gratitude, the more you will want to benefit others. Whew, so much more one can say about this. Really, I needed 11 sessions for each of these qualities, but there's a headline for you to reflect upon. Gratitude's absolutely key Buddhist quality. That's why we put quite a lot of emphasis in retreats and talks and things like that on thanking the speaker, thanking the people who've arranged the retreat. At the weekend, we were thanking everybody who'd created this centre. Because if we don't thank them, it means we're not aware of what we've got. And if we're not aware of what we've got, we cannot take advantage of it. That's the main point, isn't it? That if you don't know, if you don't value what you've been given, well, you're not going to use it. If you don't value the Dhamma as it's come to you, then you won't take advantage of it. So, gratitude, a supreme Buddhist quality. You could say that usually it's said that the five Buddhist emotions are metta, karuna, mudita, upeksha, and shraddha. Loving kindness, compassion, rejoicing in merits, equanimity, non-reactivity, and faith. But I think you could easily add gratitude to that list. It's so important. It's why we're making offerings. We make offerings out of gratitude. It's why we help out at the centre and so forth. I remember a wonderful day I had with some of the volunteers at the LBC. I remember Jack was there. I think a few others of you were there. And people sat in a circle and I asked them, why are you helping out? Why are you volunteering at the LBC? And everybody said, because I've got so much from it. And some very, very movingly spoke of their experience of coming to the centre as almost like a lifesaver, the first time they'd really experienced a situation, for instance, where they could just be calm, or a situation where people were genuinely interested in them, or a situation where there was such good and sensible communication, and so on. So I was very, very moved by that, because it meant that, well, first of all, it meant the LBC was effective, but secondly, it meant that the spirit of gratitude was alive within the centre. And that is extremely important from the Bodhisattva point of view. So if you like, us as a collective Bodhisattva, us participating in the activity of the Bodhisattva, need to express this gratitude amongst us as much as we can, as genuinely as we can. And of course, gratitude is expressed not merely in words, but in deeds. If you really feel grateful, you want to help. You want to help your teacher, for instance, or your Kalyanamitras, or just those who've come to the classes with you. So, number three. Number four, five, and six, I'm going to lump together a bit. I'll tell you what they are, first of all, and then I'll talk a little bit about them. Three, of course, is at the top of page six. It's the first para. Four is the second para. Five is the third and fourth para. And six is the fifth para. So the Bodhisattva protects frightened sentient beings from fear. Especially, of course, sharks and tigers. And zombies, I note. It's a very topical issue, isn't it? No doubt vampires come in here too, because we're all worried about them at the moment, apparently. of course, this is all framed in a different time. We probably have our own fears, maybe not so different from these, but I'll leave you to fill in the blanks. But there's a lot of fear in the world. A lot of fear. Sometimes you can see it in people's faces if you're out and about. It's not usually outright terror, although sometimes you see that. It's usually anxiety, worry, that things are going to go wrong, that things are going to go bad. I have been in situations, mainly in India, but also in Hungary, where people are outright terrified of what may be coming. I was in Hungary a few years ago when the extreme right-wing Jobbik party was rising, fascist in all, well, I was going to say in all but name, practically in name too. And they were coming to the village where our Mitras are running a school. People were terrified. Absolutely terrified. So fear is probably a predominant emotion throughout the world, and we know the situation in the world today. So many people suffer from acute fear, fear of violence towards them. A lot of people fear of not being able to continue the struggle, of not being able to get the living that they need, their children not being fed, their children not getting what they need. Fear is a terrible blight. So the Bodhisattva protects people from fear. Furthermore, he relieves the sorrow of sentient beings who have suffered a calamity, beginning with the calamities involving relatives and friends. Yeah, both calamities with relatives and friends, because they die and they have catastrophes. And if you live in a more traditional society, any member of your family affects you. But also because relatives and friends quarrel and can be difficult. The sorrow of death of parents, the sorrow of the death of children and spouse, of female and male servants, of staff and employees, of friends, counsellors, paternal and maternal relations, and of such persons as teachers, preceptors and gurus. Sorrow in that way, in the sense of death, of disaster, is an inevitable aspect of life. And any circumstance in which you talk, I'm sure there are people right now in this room who are working with that sort of suffering. It's bound to be the case because it's a universal fact. Then there's all sorts of calamities connected with property. As soon as you own property, you have worries. Yeah? You all know. See Maitri Vajri going around with looking at all the leaks in the building. As soon as you have some possessions, you can lose them. Something can go wrong. And even if you insure them, it's not always possible to recoup what you paid. And anyway, insurance companies try not to pay you. So a lot of a problem from property because of clumsiness, stolen by robbers, carried off by fire or water, gone to waste by being badly stored in the treasuries. You know, you put together a whole lot of rice, and I've seen this happen, and the rats get in because you haven't secured the door. So a whole year's worth of food is just gone, or mildew gets in, resulting in ruin because the work was misapplied, carried off by unfriendly inheritors, or internal family squabbling. Somewhere in here, oh yeah, confiscated by the king. Compulsory purchase order. Your hard-won, you know, property, you've spent your life building it, letter through the post, you're out. And of course, in many parts of the world, it's much more dramatic than that. Just a bunch of guys with guns come along and tell you to move on. And I've seen that. Well, I've heard of that, rather. So that's sorrow, suffering in the most immediate sense, suffering from loss of those close to you, and loss of the property you've identified yourself with and that is the support for your life. The Bodhisattva helps you to deal with it. Then sixthly, the Bodhisattva provides requisites for those who want requisites. That is the basis of life. Food, drink, housing, clothing, etc. Although it goes a little bit further than that, because he also supplies ornaments to those who want ornaments. It's interesting, isn't it? Because in the context of a traditional society, if you don't have certain ornaments, then you lose your place in society. For instance, again, sorry for the continuous references to India, but in India, a married woman wears a chain round her neck, a Mangal Sutra, which signifies her married status. Without it, well, she has no status, and it can be quite serious. So some element of ornamentation is sort of part of your social identity, etc. It provides unguent to those who want perfume. The commentary on this commentary helpfully says it provides perfume to those who are smelly. not to put too fine a point upon it. And illumination to those who want illumination. Light. Again, you know, sometimes in slums, children are having to study, but they have no light to study by. So you see sometimes children, you know, if you look through, go through a slum, you see children sitting at a table with a candle in front of them, just sort of poring over their books, trying to prepare the lesson for the next day. So I needn't labour the point. The Bodhisattva helps people who are frightened, tries to protect them from fear. The Bodhisattva helps people who are suffering, who are in sorrow, who are sad. The Bodhisattva helps people with the necessities of life. Again, I could go into each of these in some detail, but time does not permit. So I wanted to lay down some general principles, really, which we have to calibrate how we're going to respond in any given situation. Sometimes you may just have to say, I can't do anything about that. I just don't have the resources. And if I do that, then I'm not doing this. sometimes you have to sort of target. That's where the assessing needs and working out how to do it. I say, first of all, there's the immediate response. If, you know, somebody in the retreat is, you know, gets some bad news and is in terrible sort of pain, well, somebody needs to go and be with them. Often just enough just to be with people. My experience, often when people are suffering a lot, the less you say, the better. It's just to be with them. I think it's the same with people who are frightened. Often it's just being with them that does the job. So, you respond to those needs you find immediately around you, especially amongst those to whom you are grateful. You respond immediately, practically, and so on. Then, of course, you respond, as it were, humanly. I was going to say psychologically, but let's not put it like that, because it sounds like you get them lying on a couch and sit at the end and start finding out about their potty training. No, I mean just being warm and friendly and trying to help them to sort of change their mood just by your very positive and effective communication with them. You can lift people in that way. And actually, I think where fear is concerned, confidence is the most positive contribution you can make. And I've been in that situation where people are really, really frightened. And if you're not frightened, you're not worried, you're reasonably confident for whatever reason, either because you're so stupid you haven't seen the danger, or because you've got the strength to overcome it. I'm not going to comment on my own past performance. If you're really confident, if you're genuinely confident, not foolishly confident, of course, but if you're genuinely confident, it can steady other people's nerves. It can be quite astonishing. Somebody with real confidence can calm everything down. The panic sort of subsides if somebody is balanced, is centered, and confident. We can do something. Yeah, it's terrible, but we can manage. We can sort it out. Of course, there's another dimension, which is sometimes you encounter sufferings that are systemic. If you see what I mean, the example that I'm most familiar with is the suffering that comes from caste, which is dreadful if you're at the bottom of the caste heap in a village, an Indian village, or even outside that. It can be really dreadful. No real vision above you. You're just pinned down, and you encounter opposition, barrier at every turn. Even our whole movement can't sort that out in itself. We can help this person or that person. We can give opportunities for people to come out of that. We have done that. We've contributed to that work. But there's a systemic problem, which is built into the culture, into the society. And so sometimes you have to have a response that is more to do with changing law or changing culture. Of course, it's much easier to change law, and that's difficult enough, much more difficult to change culture. I've seen this going on in Hungary with our Roma Mitras there. They're up against a system and a mentality. And in a way, there's very little they can do about it. What they do is they cooperate with other forces, political forces, social forces, that are trying to change things. This is why it's important that we vote, for instance, and that we vote in a way that actually does resolve at least some of the problems in the world. There are so many, and no political party has a monopoly on solving them all, if you like. But we need to make sure that we use our citizenship to try to change the way in which the law works, the way in which the administration works, so that Fewer people suffer, or those who do suffer get what they need in order to escape from it. It's a complex question, but I want to just point in that direction, that we do, as citizens, need to address the larger systemic problems. Then there's much deeper issues, aren't there? Much deeper issues about culture. A culture within which, for instance, it's always easier to talk about another culture than our own, but within which human beings are graded according to their birth. That was still the case to some extent because of the class system in Britain and because of racism in places. There's still a tendency to think because somebody's born into a certain category, they're of a certain level or whatever. So stereotyping, fixing people. So we need to be working with that. That's difficult. And our Buddhist movement is trying to do that in a way at the deepest level by trying to spread the Dhamma, which is ultimately the answer to these systemic problems. Cultural systemic issues. We're trying to create a new culture. It's a vast task, and we're just a tiny handful of people. It's a quixotic venture. But when you think the Buddha in the deer park at Saranas, had just five disciples. And now Buddhism, well, until the 20th century, was by far the largest world religion. The Buddha's message had spread universally. So one does need to have that sort of perspective, that we can, if we can really communicate the Buddhist perspective, it can have a widespread effect upon society. I've seen it in India to some extent. I've seen that the lives of 30 or 40 million people changed because of Buddhism. Because of the Buddha Dhamma, they've dropped their idea of themselves as low. They've come to think of themselves as human beings. They've come to think that they have the capacity to change themselves and to change the world around them. They've escaped from the presuppositions that their culture has given them. Of course, it has to go much wider than that. But we do need to believe that the Buddha Dhamma, if it's widely heard and practiced, can change society. That, personally, where I wish to put my main efforts, because I believe in the long run, this will be the best solution. I don't know if it's going to work. It may be quixotic, tilting at windmills and so forth, but I think the issue goes so deep that it needs a really radical resolution. Materialism is a dead end. The materialism that dominates modern Western culture, to use that term, and is increasingly spreading through the world, is a dead end. It goes nowhere. The fundamentalism that's paralleling it is just going to create more and more tension and violence. This neo-fascism that we're seeing in Hungary, in Poland, in Turkey, in Egypt, in India, etc., etc., is just going to promote more and more national tensions. And again, it's usually dominance by a small clique, crony capitalists and the like, Putin's Russia. These are the forces of the world today. And if we can really make the Buddha Dhamma felt in the world, it has some chance of influencing the total perspective of things. It's amazing how much Buddhism has spread since I was a young lad. I came into Buddhism when I was 23. And at that time, if you mentioned the word Buddhism, most people would have no idea what you were talking about. Now most people know something about it, and it has a very good reputation, if you like. And it's had quite a big cultural effect. So I certainly do feel that the best answer we can give to the deeper issues of fear, of suffering, of want, is to be found in the Buddha Dhamma, and that a lot of our effort must be going in there. Of course, there's even a deeper dimension than that. which I think we always need to remember when we're helping individuals with their difficulties. We need to be pointing to the fact that all suffering comes from attachment. That's the fundamental teaching of the Buddha, isn't it? The Four Noble Truths. First truth is suffering. The second truth is the cause of suffering, which is attachment. Of course, you don't do this, you know, in a callous and superficial way. Oh, yeah, your house is burned down. Never mind, it's all impermanent. And anyway, you were attached. That would be just awful. It would be really awful. And they would have a perfect right, with breaking no precepts, to bop you one on the nose. But there should be, at some point in any deep discussion with people who are suffering in these sort of ways, the possibility of arriving at a point where you begin to see that the suffering is connected with you. Suffering is not caused out there. Yes, there is an external set of conditions, as Shantideva, the great bodhisattva of the Madhyamaka school, paralleling Asanga, he taught that if somebody beats you, reflect, they provided the stick, but you provided the body. Something to tell yourself, probably not to tell somebody when they've just been beaten up. That would be inhuman. But at some point, we all need to recognize that the sources of suffering are in ourselves, in our own consciousness. And although it's an unimaginably vast task, we can surmount that. We can become free of suffering. And oddly, if you can really see that, even if you can't yet do it, it changes the nature of the situation. If you see that the suffering that you're experiencing, whatever kind, the fear that you're experiencing, is in the end coming from your own mind, even if you can't get rid of it, you've now become responsible for it, if you see what I mean. You've become, you've taken it on. And you're not throwing it out to others. You escape from victimhood, which is the worst state that a human being can be in, where you just think, it's a wonderful phrase in Hindi, which you hear again and again, mai kya kar sakta hoon, what can I do? It's not in my hands. If you feel like that, you're just doomed, and doomed to suffer even more. So at some point in any bodhisattva communication, if you can, you arrive at the stage where you can help people to see this is in their hands. So there's a very few broad comments on how we sort of work out how to assess the needs and how to assess our response. You just respond if somebody's sitting next to you and is in pain or whatever. You just respond. You don't sit there and think, should I do that or should I do that? You just respond out of that gratitude, if you see what I mean. And you try to do what you can to help them in the most immediate sense. Then you go deeper down to try to give them some solace, some emotional support, some solace in that sense. If it's something that's much more systemic, as I put it, that's more to do with political and social and legal conditions and so forth, you begin to try to help participate in a process that will change that. And yes, ultimately, if you possibly can, if you've got a context for doing it, you take your Kalyanamitrata to the point at which you help people to see that they have some power in this case, even ultimate power in this particular case of escaping from suffering, because we all suffer. Suffering is implicit in existence. Believe me, as you get older, you find this more and more. If you don't already, I've had a very easy life, very little pain, but age begins to get to you, and the aches start. And So it will come. If it's not now, it will come. One needs to start coming to terms with suffering. Coming to terms with suffering means knowing its essential conditioned character and its inevitability, and that it is directly related to your own attachment to self. So the Bodhisattva offers help in accordance with the opportunity, in accordance with the needs of the individual, in accordance with the circumstances, at whatever level is possible, always reaching to this deepest level and trying to inject into society as a whole that perspective through the teaching of the Dhamma, and getting that teaching of the Dhamma out into the byways and of society, getting it on the radio, getting it on the television, getting it into films, getting it so that it's before people and that they can experience it. Often without a Buddhist label. There are countries where you can't put a Buddhist label on it, but it can still be there. It can still be affecting people. So, one more, because time rushes on. And in a way, this is one of the most interesting and one of the most immediately relevant to our work, especially sitting here in this wonderful retreat centre so newly created. So the furthermore, this is the last para on page 6. Furthermore, the Bodhisattva, with the ethics of gathering, performs an act of gathering by attracting a crowd of sentient beings. With no thought of self-interest, backed only by a thought of mercy, that is compassion, he gives himself, herself, as a resource, to give oneself as a resource. Very resonant phrase, been echoing in my mind all night, knowing I was going to talk about it today. Giving oneself as a resource. He subsequently seeks, in accord with the doctrine, robe, that is the Dhamma, robes, food, bed and bedding, medicinal drugs and other requisites from faithful Brahmins and householders for their sake. His own robes, food, bed and bedding, it's a monastic context, if you see what I mean, so thinking in terms of the monastic robes, which he obtains in accord with the Dhamma, he uses in common and not privately. He shares. Again, such an important thing, because leaders often get extra privileges. Sometimes they need a bit of cosseting. If it becomes just a source of accumulation of your own, aggrandizement of yourself and getting goods for yourself, private accumulation, well, it becomes counterproductive. It becomes a betrayal. From time to time, he gives appropriate advice in 8 modes. These are essentially the antidotes to unskillful mental states. So metta bhavana, in order to overcome hatred. Asubha bhavana, the cultivation of awareness of the unwholesome, the ugliness for those who are over-attached. A cultivation of the 6 elements, a contemplation of the 6 elements for those who are conceited, and so on. So it's the application of the Dhamma in a more minute way to your own mental states. And the lessons are lessons in the practice of the precepts. How to get rid of unskillful states, how to cultivate skillful states, how to keep skillful states in being, how to prevent unskillful states from arising. So you're helping people to learn how to be ethical, helping them to work with their mental states, and not just in the superficial sense, but very deeply towards insight itself. So, what on earth does this mean? He performs an act of gathering, attracting a crowd of sentient beings. It doesn't mean he sort of becomes a transcendental pop star. What it means is that he creates a community. He creates a sangha. The word for a crowd is gunna, which is a common word in modern Indian languages. In fact, some of you know anything about, if any of you know anything about Hinduism, there's the elephant-headed god who's Ganapati, which means the lord of the people. But Ganna is another term that is used for Sangha. So it means he creates a Sangha, he creates a community, or she. He gathers, the Bodhisattva gathers around themselves a community of people who are sort of drawn by the Dhamma as expressed through that Bodhisattva. That is what our order is. It's the result of Sangharakshita's act of gathering. When you see it sort of spelled out like this, it's a bit humbling. When you realize that he took the set of vows which are implied by these 11 modes, it makes one realize what he's done. I don't think he sort of did it in a very self-conscious way, but he took this vow, which involves creating a community which is not just a bunch of people, but is a living culture within which ethical and Dhammic values are alive, where people relate to each other in a new way, and where the circumstances, the conditions they require, are gradually gathered. So this centre, this retreat centre, this wonderful retreat centre, is the manifestation of this spirit, of the Bodhisattva spirit, of gathering a crowd and providing the resources. Because it's not just that the Bodhisattva gathers a crowd and then he or she sort of sits above them, sort of showering out everything that's needed. What the Bodhisattva does is create a community that does that job, if you see what I mean, creates a manifestation of the Bodhisattva spirit. Do you see what I mean? So we're all participants in this. Very, very striking at the weekend when the centre was being opened, a number of people spoke about who had contributed to setting it all up. And, every time they had to say, and of course there are many other people who we can't mention, because there's countless people, thousands of people, I'm sure, who've contributed in one way or another to setting this all up, who've brought it all together, this set of buildings which embody our values, the values that are the values implicit in this text. So many people have created it because the idea of a single individual doing everything is contradictory, if you see what I mean. If the Bodhisattva cannot create other Bodhisattvas, he or she is not a Bodhisattva, if you see what I mean. They're an egotist. My Bodhisattva activity. Get off, I'm saving all sentient beings, you go away. What the Bodhisattva does is sort of create the spirit of the Bodhisattva as something that's living and living through our connection with each other, the culture that we share. And the Bodhisattva does it by giving themselves as a resource. This is perhaps for me one of the most profound phrases in this whole text. The Bodhisattva gives themselves as a resource. So, I spoke yesterday or the day before, some day or other, about recognizing that you have to recognize that you're a particular human being. You're a particular manifestation of conditions. I'm a particular manifestations of immediate post-war English, white, middle class, etc., 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 material. It's all sort of come together and formed this object you see before you. It has to be something particular. But what we have to do, if we give ourselves as a resource, is we say, well, this particular spatio-temporal combination, this set of conditions, I will put at the disposal of something more than me. I will try to let a spirit that is beyond me function through me, something that is, if you like, not to do with space and time, that is not encapsulable in space and time. I try to let it work through me. That's what the Bodhisattva does. He or she gives themselves as a resource. They offer themselves as they actually are. They don't try to be something they're not. They don't change their accent or put on makeup or whatever. They use themselves as they are at the service of something beyond themselves. We've all got to be something particular, and whatever we are, it's not good enough, I assure you. It's imperfect. It's not this. It's not that. But whatever it is what it is, and it's valuable. If we put it at the service of the spirit that this text is trying to capture, we can draw people together and help them to do the same. Maybe to a lesser extent to begin with. Maybe some will do it more than us very quickly. This is what we're doing. This is what the LBC is all about. It's about gathering a crowd. Ganna parigrahane parigrahana shilena. The ethics of gathering people together, gathering a community, creating a living community which is manifests as a culture which is imperfectly, not completely, never finished, somehow channeling, to put it that way, of something that is not encapsulated in space and time. That's what this whole movement is about. And Bhante wrote to me a few years ago saying that when he thought back on his life and thought about the way in which the movement had started, and I knew him fairly soon after the movement had started, and you would not have believed this at that point. It was a grubby, damp, cramped basement in the centre of a rather, at that time, down at heel part of London. It's rather fashionable now, but that time is pretty down at heel. And we were a pretty down at heel mob. There was more hair than brains in the room. It was the 60s. But the feeling he always got from Bhante was he wasn't particularly sort of bothered. He wasn't particularly planning. He hadn't thought, I know, in 2016, we'll have a centre in the depths of Suffolk countryside, and we'll call it Vajrasana. Wasn't anything like that. He was just following each step as it came, responding to the circumstances as they emerged, and that something was sort of working through him. And that's what he says. He says that looking back, it doesn't seem to him that he, as it were, initiated or, in a sense, created all this. Although, objectively speaking, he knows he played the lion's share of the work, at least in the early stages. But he says it felt to him as if something, a force, was working through him. He's not trying to theologize that. He's just talking, as it were, poetically about the way it felt, that he was trying to let the Dhamma speak through him. And as he drew people to him, beginning to help them to let it speak through them, and so on. So that now, many thousand people all over the world are influenced by and are themselves opening up to that same sort of force. So this, in some ways, is the Bodhisattva activity par excellence. And in some ways, it should be the point on which we end, but I'm being rigorously systematic and going through it in order. So maybe we need to sort of keep that element of it alive, this sense of as a budding bodhisattva, as one trying to practice this active vipassana in action, you're trying to give yourself as a resource to a principle, if you like, which is not just a sort of thought, but is a living principle, something that's active, almost like a force. You can get terribly sentimental about this if you overspeak it, but allowing something to work through you that is more than you. And the force of that will be to draw people to you so they begin to do it too. And so that we collectively manifest the bodhisattva, this principle that goes beyond us as individuals. So we'll leave it there, have a half-hour break, and come back for the what's left, which in a way takes us down to another level, but let's see, maybe not.